This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
You can never know what it's like. You blood like a winter freezes just like ice. And there's a cold and lonely light that shines from you. You will wander like the wreck you hide behind that mask you use.
Well, in the New York Times podcast, your traumatizing and traumatic musical biopic of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
But I never could have hoped to win. You started down the road and made me again. The threats you made were meant to cut me down. And if I love just a circus, then you'd be a clown by now. You're still standing better than I ever did. Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. I'm still standing after all this time, picking up the pieces of my life without you on my mind. I'm still standing.
I should say now that I have very fond memories of I'm Still Standing from when I was a young person. I did not know it was about overcoming years of drug and sex addiction. But that's the beauty of pop music, is that it filters all of that into a nice cradled little package that a 10-year-old can carry around and sing many years later. We're going to talk about films about music today. I feel like there's been a bunch in recent months in the post-Star is Born supernova moment. A lot has happened. We've got the VIP crew of film criticism here. This is a very heavy hitters episode. This is Case Lay on a Sunday night. This is very real. To my right, it's Tony Ayo Scott, co-chief film critic of the New York Times. What's good?
Still standing?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not well. No, you're in an Aeron chair. To be fair,
no, that's true.
Is this even a real Aeron chair?
You can't plant me in your penthouse, Caramonica.
Oh, fine.
Going back to my plow.
Well, I had to sell the penthouse to pay for all the shoes. So what can you do? Sitting across from me, it's Cam Collins, who's film critic of Vanity Fair.
How's it going?
It's great. What's the shirt you're wearing?
A little Lauryn Hill action?
Lauryn Hill? Okay.
It's not mine, but I'm wearing it.
Wow. You want to share whose it is?
They left it at my place, so it's mine now.
Well, and if you're listening, whoever that might be, you are now one shirt light. I just want to know. I feel like maybe a person who would leave the Lauryn Hill shirt at your house.
They don't deserve it.
They don't deserve it, but they're also probably a podcast listener. That's like the kind of listener we've got. So, to whoever you are out there, RIP to your shirt. Looks great on Cam, by the way. And finally, it's Kristen Yunsu Kim. Kristen writes about film for Pitchfork and many other places and has covered many of the films that we're going to discuss today. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, great to be here.
And as you reminded me, we were both at BMI's wedding.
We were.
And we didn't get a chance to meet, but here we are.
This is
two first times. This is two first times. I'm very excited.
Shout out to BMI.
Shout out to BMI. Yeah. Shout out to Ileana.
Yes, of
Shout
course.
Out to Meow Wolf. Shout out to Scott from the Santa Fe Vintage Warehouse. Like, you want to, do you want to run through my whole Santa Fe trip? The White Sands? We do the White Sands action? We do the whole thing. Anybody wants recommendations of Santa Fe, hit me, podcast@nytimes.com. We started off, that was from Rocket Man. Rocket Man is about Elton John. Elton John was a famous musician for many years ago and now is less famous as a musician, but still very famous. Rocket Man is one of many films we're going to be talking about today. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Bohemian Rhapsody, Vox Lux, Her Smell. I didn't see Teen Spirit. Did anybody see Teen Spirit?
I saw it.
One out of four. You'll chime in. You'll tell us what we missed. Blaze, I didn't see the dirt either. Nobody saw the dirt. Who saw the dirt? All right, shout some Machine Gun Kelly. We respect your artistry. Sorry we didn't catch it. And finally, the Miley Cyrus episode of Black Mirror, which at minimum I have a lot of feelings about. So I want to confess something right now, which is that I failed to see Bohemian Rhapsody, which was apparently a very well, I don't want to say well-received, because that would imply it's critically lauded. It certainly did win some prizes, but as I told you guys before we started recording, Bushwick Bill died yesterday, and I had to write an obituary, and the 6 hours it probably would have taken me to get through Bohemian Rhapsody, I didn't have. Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody, from what I loosely gather, are working in some similar narrative arcs and frameworks, but I could be wrong.
Well, they're kind of overlapping. I mean, they're sort of directed by the same guy, actually. Yeah. Even though Brian Singer got the credit on Bohemian Rhapsody, it was mostly Dexter Fletcher, the credited director of... Also, the fact that the villain in Rocket Man, the manager, John Reed... Mm-hmm. Actually managed both Elton John and Queen.
Is that
in the
true?
1970s.
Yes, that is true.
That is.
Lord.
I was very proud in a kind of, you know, sort of geeky and vain way that I managed to write a whole review of Rocket Man without mentioning
Bohemian Rhapsody
and without having to deal with the fact that I quite liked one of them, Rocket Man.
I really enjoyed Rocket Man. You've seen both.
I really disliked Rocket Man.
Yes!
Oh, wow.
And
Fight.
I despised Bohemian Rhapsody.
Okay, well, that's, okay. So you still liked Rocket Man more?
A little more, yeah.
Okay. So like a two, a three and a two, kind
Something
of.
Something like that, you know, yeah.
What is it about the films that you found despicable?
Both of them?
In either order.
Oh, man. I feel that Rocket Man is kind of an interesting failure. That might be giving it almost too much credit.
Yeah.
I do, it makes me wonder, like, oh, why aren't more music biopics actual musicals? I guess Elton John's music and theatrics kind of lend themselves more, you know, to that kind of stuff. It was just, even just from the first scene, I just was not.
Eyes
no.
rolling all the way.
You know,
the back.
Like it starts with this gag where he's in AA, and it feels very much like Elton John being like, "Oh, let me just tell you how messy my life was," and then we're all very uncomfortable trying to laugh at this because it's almost like a comedic gag in my opinion.
Is there a running narrative trick in Bohemian Rhapsody as well that's sort of similar?
Yes, it begins. Both of them have the sort of the moment and then the flashing back from the moment. So so Bohemian Rhapsody, it's Live Aid. He's coming out, which is the sort of the great triumphant moment. And then it sort of goes back to, and it's remarkable, as is often true of musical biopics, like every single musician of note who's had a fictional or not, who's had a movie made out of them, seems to have exactly the same life story.
It's true.
The childhood unhappiness and then the rise to success.
That's why music
and
journalism's dead.
The excess and then
it's
the
just
recovery.
Mad Libs at this point.
I mean, it kind of is. They're sort of the same movie.
Yeah, in that way.
I also, and we'll get to this in a minute, but the thing that irritated me most about Rocket Man was that kind of recurrent, I don't know what film critics would call it, but like the structure where there's this, you know what I'm talking about, where you keep returning back to the room where he's in Alcoholics Anonymous or Sex Addicts Anonymous or whatnot. Blaze was like that with the Townes Van Zandt radio interview, which I found utterly irritating.
But Blaze had like three different ones. That's what I liked about it. It kept sort of forgetting what, because it also had that concert. So it has the interview after the main character, Blaze Foley, has already. I don't know if anyone saw this movie, and I don't know if anyone but me liked this movie, but it's the Ethan Hawke biography of the sort of like dirtbag Texas troubadour songwriter Blaze Foley. But most of it is just like him and Aaliyah Shawcott shacked up in a treehouse in their underwear.
I thought that was cute.
That was great.
That sounds great.
It was actually, I found it very charming. I will say that the thing about Blaze that you mentioned about how it sometimes it's the concert and sometimes it's the Townes Van Zandt thing, the thing about Blaze I found funny is I think there maybe are only four scenes in Blaze. They just each last 20 to 25 minutes and they're chopped together.
They're sort of chopped together.
Yeah, they're kind of chopped together, but I kept being like, weren't they in the treehouse like 30 minutes ago? But then now they're still in the treehouse.
Well, yeah, they get you. Who's got to go back to the tree? I mean, that's a very much
that's
back
their garden,
to your roots.
That's the Garden of Eden. That's their Garden of Eden. Okay, so someone explain to me why Bohemian Rhapsody was trash.
Wow.
Where to begin? I mean, take it.
Wait,
Cam,
are you about to defend Bohemian Rhapsody?
Me? Oh, yeah. No.
Okay.
No.
Good.
No.
Never. Well, okay, please do not put that into the world. I would like to make it clear that I'm not a fan of that film. Although, I mean, no, actually not although. I was going to try to say something nice about it.
No, don't. I mean, unless you...
I think it was useful for me. I hate kind of phrases that start like as a queer person, but you know, Brooklyn Pride was this weekend, so I'm going to go ahead and start there and say like it was educational for me to see the extent to which you're going to have a movie about a queer person, a person who died of AIDS, mm-hmm. and try to mainstream that, like what the cost of that mm-hmm. might be, and also what the conversations about it are going to be when the movie makes millions and millions of dollars worldwide, and it is very clear that internationally, like the public is not really that interested in the faults in this film, that people liked this film a lot, mm-hmm. that when I went home to talk to my family, my mom wanted to talk to me about it. She didn't want to talk to me about If Beale Street Could Talk, or even Moonlight when that came out, or even Selma when that came out, mm-hmm. but Bohemian Rhapsody, like we talked about, mm-hmm. because everyone saw it. But for me, it was kind of painful to see that we weren't going to have a broader cultural discussion about, well, what does this mean in terms of how we depict the queer life of this person? It's a huge part of his music. It's a huge part of the story. But we're going to reduce it in the story to one kind of vague romance and some gas station bathroom hookups and cocaine and things that I do not think quite get at the nature of his relationship to sex.
Do you think that the erasings were consistent with the erasings that were happening in real time in his public presentation, or do you think that they were above and beyond?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Because when mm-hmm. we turn things into movies, it's almost kind of not important what really happened, mm-hmm. to be honest, because we're making a movie.
Yes.
So I don't know. I would say that his relationship to his actual sexuality seemed to be much more complicated than I think a film like this could really get at. I also think that the surviving members of the band had more control over the story than he obviously did. So that's also what we're getting in that film. It's complicated.
Which is mm-hmm. another difference with Rocketman, which is executive produced and fully authorized by Elton John.
Right.
But it's interesting because there are similar beats there too, where both Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody and Elton John in Rocketman kind of fall under the spell of their first important gay lover who is also involved in their business and is their man, becomes their sort of their manager, and is in both cases a very kind of sinister and predatory figure. And one difference is I think in Bohemian Rhapsody, that seems to be the entirety of like of gay life. You know, it's sort of it's almost as if Freddie Mercury is kidnapped and taken off to Berlin by this kind of S&M cult, and the band and his former wife have to come and rescue him and get him to make music again. Right. Whereas Rocketman
has... Is that really what happened to Bohemian Rhapsody?
It's evil cocaine twinks.
Okay. Yeah. It was really gross in the way they kind of depicted Freddie Mercury like groveling back to his bandmates, you know, like, sorry for going off and being gay,
and
now I'm back.
My,
you
know, and chasing my bliss.
That's kind of what it felt like.
Ugh. Yeah.
And Rocketman does not do that. I mean, the interesting thing I think that Cam, what you were saying got me thinking about is how the sexuality and the sexual performance and concealment of so much 70s pop, it's just such a fascinating thing. You know, because I remember you'd hear Queen and Elton John on AM commercial radio mm-hmm. when I was a kid. Like there was nothing. It was they were as mainstream as I could get. And this is a band called Queen, and this is, you know, Elton John in these platform shoes. And yet, somehow it wasn't, I don't even know how you begin to reconstruct from the standpoint of now that those layers that were such a part of
pop culture. When visibility in those politics are so much more at the forefront of the articulated forefront of popular culture. I kept, during Rocketman, I did keep watching these kind of 70s Elton John scenes or these early 80s Elton John scenes. And I kept thinking about that thing that Eminem said, where Eminem was like, I didn't know Elton John was gay. But I was also just like,
but it's true.
Did you look?
But I had no idea. I mean, when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, it was sort of pre and early adolescence. And it just like, no. For a while, I thought he was married to Olivia Newton-John.
No, really. I just want to let, I was waiting to see how long I could let that hang there. I really tried.
That is true.
Was that fabricated on their part?
I just decided that
they were famous people.
They were both on TV.
Same surname.
They were both sort of pop couple. Stars. And like, you know, she'd hyphenated because she was a modern woman.
Oh, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
See, no, right. No. It was progressive.
See, the hyphenated part helps, I think.
Yeah.
to do the math there.
Why do these films exist? Because you talked about the Elton John film being sanctioned and executive produced by him. So it's like, obviously, while one is still alive, it's like you want to be the hagiography that you want to see in the world. You know, you could just sort of...
And you want to remonetize your catalog.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It does get into vanity project area quite a bit. You know, just like, oh my God, he's such a musical genius. Like, even in the flashback scenes, he just like knows how to play the piano perfectly, you know, right. from the get-go, things like that.
Is that also Freddie Mercury's backstory in the film? He was just like,
well, that's the funny thing. The like, I feel like the bandmates get that kind of treatment because they were involved.
Bohemian Rhapsody, I think, to the question of why does this movie exist, I think Bohemian Rhapsody is there to tell you who wrote one song, like who came up with the clapping, who came up with this kind of like performance, et cetera. And just to clarify, like who in the band did We Will Rock You, who in the band was responsible for this part, et cetera. Like, I think so that is like actually VH1, what that movie.
It's like VH1 pop-up video, which totally. Is like, yes. but just over 2 hours.
And it's memorable in that regard. I remember those kinds of details. I feel like if I were only going by that movie, the writing of the song Bohemian Rhapsody really was just like Freddie Mercury in a farmhouse humming to himself and like, oh, you know, this actually would be a great genius song.
A great anthem for a decade.
Whereas, as Kirsten was saying, in Rocketman, there's no creative struggle whatsoever.
Right. Like,
Bernie Taupin has bushels of lyrics. Yeah. He just has boxes. He's
like, drops them in the mail.
I've got 150 more songs.
He literally drops. I was also
he
just
drops
like,
them in the mail, and Elton sits down at the piano and is like, da, 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 da.
I just want to. Oh, can I just say something? I just want to say I lived in London. My experience with the Royal Mail was not that secure to where if I was writing songs, I would just be
and
like
one hand.
Yeah,
copies.
Right. That's it. I didn't even have a mimeograph machine that I just jam them into a brown envelope and put one of those like British addresses that are not really British addresses, like Merseybone 4, U76, and then just like drop it in the corner box. No. So that Bernie, the fact that Bernie just felt like, hey, no problem.
But
yeah, no.
I have to say, what this movie
made me
realize...
That was for you,
JL33,
just FYI.
That of all of the pop music careers in the world, Bernie Taupin's is the one that I would aspire to.
Yeah.
It's like we're all writers in this room. And just think about what his word rate is. He just sits in his farm. No, writing. Just writing these words. And he just sends them out there and like... You know,
it's aspirational for sure. Yeah,
and also if you believe, I don't know if Bernie get an executive producing credit on Rocketman? Because if Rocketman is to believe, Bernie also came up in the love department. Bernie was out here just killing it at parties, just like after the Troubadour, just like taking models home, just having a great life. Like is that what Bernie's really out here doing?
And then at some point he bought a ranch because when they're having their sort of their like when Elton's having
seducing
his low moment,
and
he's like. Just come out to the ranch, Elton. Come out to my ranch. We'll get back to writing songs.
Yeah.
One thing I think we're getting at, though, is that, and this is true of music movies, but also true of any artist movie, any movie about an artist, just the act of creation is really hard to dramatize. Mm-hmm. So you are going to have scenes like in Bohemian Rhapsody, but also even like an Emily Dickinson movie where someone's just sitting at a table mumbling to themselves, and that's the art. Like, we don't know how to, like, with painters.
I can't relate to that at all. I
get it. It is relatable, but there's a reason no one's making movies about me. Like, you can't make a movie about
not
that.
Not yet.
Not yet, but like with, like, you know, an athletic kind of artist or someone like Pollock or someone, you can have those like montages of running around throwing paint everywhere, but with other things it's like, really? So, you know, you're in your room practicing a lot and you're in your room writing a lot, and yeah, there's gonna be cocaine, there's gonna be parties, and that beefs up the story, but the actual music, the creation of the music, no one really wants to watch that. No one wants to know what that's like.
And that's kind of what's brilliant about Rocketman, is because it just doesn't bother with it. It's just like he just sat down and he wrote these songs and they were perfect, they came out of his fingers, and then we're gonna go on to this aspect of the movie that is my favorite thing about it, which is the just jukebox musical goofiness of it, where we're going to just turn these songs into these, we're going to get rid of any kind of historical continuity or accuracy, any kind of diegetic realism, and we're just going to have like him at the bottom of a swimming pool singing a duet with his younger self.
Okay, but see, what I found intriguing, in the same way that I was extremely frustrated with that kind of through line of the Al-Anon meeting where they kept jumping back into it, basically because I assumed the writer of the film was not good enough to write scenes that didn't require that. I don't know. I don't write films for a living, but that's just my guess. But those moments kept taking me out of the narrative. Even though obviously the point is it's meant to serve as glue, it kept taking me out of the moment. I was willing. Now, I dislike Broadway, like at a intense clip, and I do not like musicals slightest.
Oh man!
But the sort of the kaleidoscopic absurdity of Elton John's presentation, because what Rocketman has is clothes. Rocketman has outfits. So if you're already kind of giving yourself over to the ridiculousness of this universe, of this ecosystem, I didn't mind when they're just walking into a room and all of a sudden he's singing and then the child version of him is also singing and also the manager is singing and also Nan comes in and she's got six bars. And at a certain point, I was like, that's fine.
I love that, actually. Yeah. Because we're talking about Elton John.
Yeah.
So right. We're talking about some of the least authentic pop music ever put to record. No, I don't mean that in a bad. I find authenticity a really overrated,
a terrible trope
criterion. Oh. But no, I mean, Crocodile Rock, like that is of all of the fake Roots, you know, songs ever recorded, that's got to be the thing. I mean, there's no such thing.
Do you mean all the Dodgers outfits that year were not sequined? Is that what you're telling me? Because I could have sworn just for that season they were all wearing sequins.
So it's just, you know, what I liked was most of his recordings in the early and mid-70s, his sort of canonical recordings, were before the age of music video. So in a way, it was like, okay, now we're going to make up for lost time and get a chance to make the MTV videos that he might have made, you know, in 1973.
This has got me thinking about the fact that more of these movies could learn to embrace the fact that they're musicals.
Yep.
I feel like the ideal version of any kind of movie like this, and I haven't seen a recent, at least, musical biopic to do this, but I feel like Fosse's All That Jazz is probably the best model because it is about performance, it is about creation, it is a good musical, and it is also deeply self-analytical. Like, if you want to have ideas about yourself as an artist, this is the way to do it. It's not just about getting the record straight. It's a little bit about that, but it's really, I mean, in his case, it delves into self-hatred. It gets into some murky, complicated places that are bigger and broader and richer than I think what we're allowed to have right now. To your point about like the musical sequences in Rocketman being what stood out to you, I felt that way about Straight Outta Compton even.
Yep.
That the concert scenes, I for much of the movie I was like, this is fine, this is John Singleton light, that's okay. Mm-hmm. And then the concert scenes, I was like, this is the movie to me. Mm-hmm. This is the movie that I want to watch. It's them performing. It's them writing music. It's that stuff.
And also there is, I'm reminded, based off what you guys are just talking about, I'm reminded of how rapping worked in 8 Mile, which is it was literally part of the script. They are musical numbers, but they're conversational, and he's stepping in and out of rapping.
Right.
And now, obviously, there's a different thing about battle rapping and like a huge orchestrated pop song, which requires suspension of disbelief to jump from regular conversation to the delivery of such a song. But I do remember thinking in that film how effortless it felt going back and forth between what we are conceiving of as quote-unquote performance moments and narrative conversational moments.
Right.
Don't we all just spontaneously break, you know.
But it also, it lets...
Drop
it
a 16 on mom every now and again.
all the time.
Yeah.
But it lets the songs carry the emotions in a way that's non-literal and that's theatrical, so that the way that they perform, say, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road does more to get at the sort of the complicated drama of Elton John's inner and interpersonal life than any of the scenes that are kind of depicting that life, which are mostly just him like drinking vodka straight out of the bottle and sticking his nose into a mountain of cocaine.
Maybe I'm a prude, but there was more cocaine than I was expecting in this film. Not that there's no cocaine in other films.
Well, but
I just was surprised because sometimes you see a film and they do something once just to like let you know.
This is like Scarface.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. There's at least like 5 distinct scenes. It's kind of like I got it. Like this is the 70s. Like I kind of get it.
No, but I think it's important because I think it was there was an interview maybe with the Guardian or someone where Elton John said, "Look,
with his cocaine deal."
No, he said, "Look, if you lived in L.A. in the 1970s." And your cocaine consumption was worthy of comment, was like, you know, at an unusual, then you were doing a lot. Mm-hmm. And he said, and I was like, I was the guy.
Yes.
Everyone else was doing it. And it was like, oh, but Elton, he's really
about that life. So these films exist, like you say, to revitalize catalogs, to serve as living hagiography, to basically convince people that the creative act of inventing Bohemian Rhapsody is like can be distilled down into three visual beats and also happened in this kind of pure way. For those of us who have seen the film, who are not me, what would be a good thing to play? And also, is the music actual Queen music?
It's actual Queen
music.
It's actual
Queen music. That's what I thought.
It's not. It's lip-synced. It's not.
Right, right.
So what did he win an Oscar for? But never mind.
No, it's true. That on Oscar night, when they showed his moment of great acting, it's he hits three notes on the piano and then lip-syncs something. It's like, wow.
Right. You know. Whereas Terrence sang his own songs for Rocket
right.
Man.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And mm-hmm. they're different versions.
Yeah.
They're sort of
right.
Which also gives it a slightly jukebox musical
right, yes.
feel. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I know this song.
And Jamie Foxx's Ray Charles, I think, sets a sort of standard for this kind of performance where he
True
does
mm-hmm.
everything.
Yeah.
I thought
you don't all have to do that to win the Oscar, but I'm just saying.
I thought we were gonna talk about the New Edition miniseries for a second. That's you want to talk about what should win prizes is the new edition miniseries. My lord. Oh my god. Costume design, production. Don't get me started. I might go home and watch that tonight. Just for like a fourth time. Man. Anyway, let's listen briefly to something from Bohemian Rhapsody, which is not Rami Malek singing Freddie Mercury. It is Freddie Mercury singing Freddie Mercury as Rami Malek moves his mouth. Let's listen to the Live Aid version of We Are the Champions.
I've did my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
A thing that we haven't explicitly talked about yet, but seems worth mentioning is also just for the actors in these things.
Yeah.
These are star vehicles, and it's bigger than just even the ones that have come out since The Star is Born, although mm-hmm. Gaga and Bradley Cooper are obviously a part of it. But there's also, you know, Ethan Hawke starred in a Chet Baker movie. Mm-hmm. Don Cheadle did a Biles Davis movie. And so, like, these are star vehicles. I think it's worth, like, you know, these are ways for actors to make movies about performers without seeming so vain that they're making a movie about an actor.
And it goes all the way back, too. I mean,
it does.
Cary Grant played Cole Porter in right. Night and Day, and Jimmy Stewart played Glenn Miller in The Glenn Miller Story.
Right.
And Sissy Spacek played Loretta Lynn and Patsy Cline.
Wonderfully. That's a great one, yeah.
A great one. That, I mean, for me, like, the gold standard of the sort of straight-ahead musical biopic.
I'm perfectly fine with making Sissy Spacek the queen of the genre. That's great for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could have stopped. We could have stopped there.
Nothing ever stops.
No, that's true. As we were saying, so those two films, Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocketman, is one sort of film, which are these hero narratives, actors take them on, like you say, so they're not so vain to play another actor, but they get to embody all the seriousness, all the sweat of creative
cocaine
execution. Yes.
and the charisma. To be people who everybody in the world loves.
Right.
You know.
So lies, which is nice. Also cocaine and that too. However, there also have been some other interesting counter-narrative films in recent memory that I would really like to talk about, because I had deep emotional reactions to at least two of these films.
Oh, wow.
One is Her Smell, and one is Vox Lux. And we'll get to Teen Spirit at the end of this. Vox Lux is what happens when you cut a film, like a physical film, into pieces and shake them up and then reorder them and then put that out in a movie theater?
That's your emotional reaction?
That's my aesthetic reaction. Yeah. My emotional reaction was largely, what is the emotion that underpins shock and resentment? Like, is there an emotion underneath that? I don't know. It made me a little ill. Vox Lux, which I think was supposed to make me a little ill, but I like to think I'm kind of like a little bit smarter than that to just get defeated by a film like this. But like, I was ultimately defeated by this film. Her Smell I found riveting in a million ways, but let's start with Vox Lux and Natalie Portman, Staten Island. I just want to say my cousins live on Staten Island. And they don't sound like that. Just for the record.
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, real talk. Like, let's all maybe take a field trip to Staten Island and see if we can identify who the source person was for this accent. Was there a voice coach?
Do you think Natalie Portman has actually ever set foot on Staten Island?
I mean, maybe on the way to Newark Airport or something. You know, not in any other sense. What's really good with Vox Lux? Can someone help me?
Oh, my God.
Kristen, just talk me through it.
I mean, like, he made a movie about a school shooting.
Yeah.
Let's start there. I felt that
Cullen Alive. Is that the kid's name? Or Cullen Awake is the shooter's name? Cullen Alive or Cullen Awake?
I repressed it. I don't.
Yeah. Wow.
I think Cullen Wake. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. There is a lot going
on. Quite a name.
That I also repressed. I think maybe this is the movie that I might call an interesting failure. Because I sort of liked it.
Or a failure at being interesting. Either one.
Yeah. Really? You know, it was commendable in, you know, just how far it went, maybe. But I think eventually it just, I wasn't sure what it was going for. Mm-hmm. Is this about, you know, appropriation of grief? Is this about, you know, pop music's failure to heal either the people listening to it or the person making it?
We should just briefly, before we go deep on that, we should say what happens in Vox Lux.
Oh, yes.
Because we said it's about a school shooting, which it is in a sense. So it opens, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, if you have gotten this far and never heard of Vox Lux and didn't listen to the last 3 minutes of us talking. So there's a school shooting. One of the victims,
Celeste goes
on to be the biggest pop star in the world.
So she gets shot in the neck, and then she writes a song in her hospital bed, and then it becomes like a giant hit.
That was never made clear. I just want to say that was told, not shown.
Yes, it, sure.
By Willem Dafoe in the
by Willem Dafoe, he was a narrator. You're right. Yeah.
Wow, forgot about that part.
Strange movie.
So she grows up to be this huge pop star. The songs were written by Sia. Natalie Portman plays the grown up version, and
yes, she does.
Yeah. I'm not going to try the accent here, but
sorry, I had some marinara sauce on my teeth. I had to get it off real fast.
So it's a two-act movie, and in the second part there is another violent act, which is terrorism, and these terrorists wear glitter masks that look like the ones that she wears on stage.
Should we play one of these Sia records?
They're not memorable, but it's really not her best work, and I'm a fan.
Let's play Private Girl.
Okay, sure.
Private Girl in a public world.
Yes.
That was like the A Star Is Born booty song. Let's play Private Girl sung by Natalie Portman as Celeste.
Now hear the fun begins. Come in and sin after sin. Look what we've got ourselves in. Maybe we'll sneak around. When the plane hits the ground, they point the lens and we're running. I'm a private girl in a public world. I'm a private girl in a public world. You know I'm a private girl. I don't need to tell the world. So I'm sticking to
Kristen, you've explained what happens in Vox Lux. My next question is, what happens in Vox Lux? I remain stymied by this film. Anybody want to speak up in defense of Vox Lux?
In defense? I should say, when I saw this and A Star Is Born at Toronto Film Festival within a couple of days of each other, mm-hmm. and I saw this second, and my immediate takeaway was that I was glad that I at least saw a movie that was about pop and how it works to some degree in a way that, like, I felt like the beginning of A Star Is Born was really going to be about and then kind of wasn't, in a way that let me down a little, even though I like that movie quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So this scratched the itch of, okay, well, at least this movie is about the problem of pop in some way. But I don't totally... I mean, first of all, there is the problem of the accent. We should say that, like, when Celeste is young, she does not have an accent.
Different,
she goes from being like
actress, yes.
Not played by Natalie Portman, right. But she goes from being like Lord to the impressions that you're doing, which are not far off, frankly.
Maybe that's what I repressed out of this film, because the Natalie Portman accent was so gratuitous.
It is artifice in a way.
What if the movie is about, you know, that accent being a consequence of early fame?
Wow!
I thought you were going to say trauma.
I thought you were going to say being shot in the neck. Which she is. She's got
her
a bullet
voice literally
in
changed.
Her.
Is that like when some people have like a sort of a terrible thing and all of a sudden they could speak French?
Right. Fluently?
We just all missed this.
Oh my
that
God.
Would make
it's
sense.
Really yeah. about, oh my God, it's really about hidden knowledges.
But I think that Cam is right. It's the director, Brady Corbett, who's also been an actor. I mean, he has ideas. He doesn't always his previous film, Childhood of a Leader, was it called, is also really interesting. Doesn't quite work, but it's trying to get at something about power and trauma. And in this case, he's sort of doing it with trauma and the power of pop music. And I think you're right that it's trying to get at something about how pop music and pop performance expresses and taps into and complicates these profoundly intimate and private but also somehow public and communal emotions that we have.
And also, this is something that I think Vox Lux did and also Rocket Man did, which is basically say you go through intense trauma as a young person and then you emerge from that and you just want to unite people, you just want to make people feel good.
Right.
It's almost as if making quote-unquote complicated music would not be an option for a person who had been through trauma. The only music that a person like that can make in these filmic universes is this kind of like centrist, unifying,
healing
pop music.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, of course, if you like peel back the scabs of any Elton John song, like you find deep trauma, I'm not sure that you find it in these alleged Celeste songs. But she even says at some point in the film, doesn't she say something to the effect of like, I just want to make, like after what I went through, like I want to bring people to together. I want
to. Yeah, she says, I just want to make music to make people feel good or something. And I think, yeah, it kind of taps into, like, you know, the idea that pop music is a bit brainless, I feel mm-hmm. like. Because she says this to a guy in a rock band, I believe.
Hmm. Oh,
yeah, that's right. That guy.
Damn.
That guy. Yeah. The scummy guy.
Yeah. What was it? He was Swedish, I guess, or Danish or something?
Something like that. I don't
European.
Remember.
She was younger. It was weird.
It was very, and like really unremarked upon. Like, because isn't she like 15 in that scene?
Yeah. Supposedly.
And it was super chill, and it was like kind of right in the same when the older sister is with the manager.
Right.
Same day or same night or same.
And then 9/11 happens.
Right. And then.
That's why it was unremarked upon.
No, I had completely forgotten.
It's true. I just pictured that as the line in the script.
And then 9/11 happens.
But I did. Okay. I did have a feeling.
We are awful people. Look at why we're laughing.
No.
Look at the laugh, the big laugh.
I just want to say that I interviewed Pete Davidson very early in his career, and one of the laugh lines in that story is him making the joke about 9/11. If it's okay for Pete Davidson,
you all forgot, but I would never forget that storyline of Vox Lux about.
I appreciate that you've been scarred because you remind me of. My reaction to it was, so my assumption, and I don't want to presume anything about the sexual history of that character, but my assumption was that was maybe either the loss of her virginity or there was something about that trip to Sweden where it's like, right. I'm drinking now and I'm with boys and here's an older guy. So there's something kind of like loss of innocence.
Yeah.
So what happens when you lose your virginity apparently is 9/11 happens. Which all the more reason that you should make healing music. I mean, this is how it's presented. Young woman kind of goes off the rails a little bit, does some things that are perceived as bad.
Having survived Columbine. For,
yeah,
right.
Like,
right.
She's
hitting
and then so she the, caused, yeah. so she survived Columbine and caused 9/11? Like,
well, there is a link between her and terrorism, that the premise of the movie.
Right.
What I find really confusing about the movie, though, and wish that it, because I, you know, it's not that I don't appreciate this realm of questions. Mm-hmm. It's more, what exactly are we saying about pop as a production process, pop as an aesthetic, et cetera, mm-hmm. that like, so terrorists like it and they draw upon it to do terrorism. I don't know how much that really has to do with pop itself. Terrorists draw upon a lot of things.
Of course.
What is it about pop? Why are we talking about pop? Why is the last third of this movie just a concert? There are questions there that I just didn't think were wrestled with and with any kind of complexity.
But I do think there's a lot of bad faith in these films about pop music. I mean, I am a pop critic. This is what I do. Yes. I write about the complexities of pop music. I believe in the depth, the polyvalence of pop music. This is literally, I'd move somewhere else and do a different job. I'd go be on American Pickers or something. You know, like I would just do something else if I didn't think that there was fundamental value.
We believe you. You have nothing to prove to us.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. But I just want to say that almost all of these films somehow are premised upon a belief that pop is unsubtle, unnuanced, Big Tent in a kind of ideological way, that it doesn't have room for resistance inside pop. And I found that so vexing because I literally engage with music that does that all the time.
Well, I mean, I think in a way that connects with what Cam was saying earlier about the difficulty of representing the creative process, because it tends to become a sort of what in the old days, like English professors used to call the genetic fallacy, which mm-hmm. is like something happened to you. How did you write this song? You know, Johnny Cash. Well, I was thinking about, you know, how much I love my wife and I heard this bass line and I wrote I Walk the Line. It's just like, just circle a little bit back to Rocket Man, is that it has some of that, but it also realizes that these songs, it doesn't work for these songs. First of all, because Elton John didn't write any of the lyrics.
Yes.
Right.
They came from somewhere else. But also, these movies, because they can't get at the complexity in which these songs are generated, can't quite appreciate the complexities that they express or that they mm-hmm. and that they come to kind of to symbolize and to communicate.
If you want to know about pop music's complexity, watch Joe's Diary of a Song series on nytimes.com. Jesus Christ. I'm just saying. Maybe some of these directors could take a cue from that. But I do want to pivot to, before we get to Her Smell, or I should say The Resistance, I do want to get briefly to this Miley episode of Black Mirror, because one of the things I did like about this Miley episode of Black Mirror is it does peel back the complexities, at minimum, of the people who make pop music, if not necessarily the songs, although it is LOL hilarious that her big hit is like a empowerment version of Head Like a Hole by Nine Inch Nails. Pedro, we got to find that song. I don't know if it's on Spotify or something.
Oh my
but
God.
But it's a riot. So we'll find it, okay? But it's hilarious. I like the cynicism underpinning whoever made that choice.
Right.
That was funny. So just for the premise of this episode, without giving away the ending of it, is that Miley plays Ashley O, who is a kind of, I guess, somewhere in the Britney to Katie axis.
Like, sure, yeah.
Not as robustly complicated as actual Miley Cyrus, although Miley has plenty of history with playing with personas herself, probably today and yesterday and the day before, in addition to 5 to 10 years ago. So she has a fan, and they sell these robots, which the robots talk to the fans as Ashley O. And then Ashley O is secretly unhappy with her setup, with her evil aunt who runs her career, and is plotting a way to get out of the contract. And the aunt gets a whiff of that and does unspeakable things to Ashley O to ensure that that will never happen. I'm not going to give all the details away, but it's certain there's a coma, and then there's a fully sentient robot and a car crash and a mouse that has a zapper in it that knocks out a big security guard. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Not getting? Because no, I watched half of episode.
The first half is not as good as the second half.
Yeah, none of what you
No, it gets really interesting. But I kept watching it, and I was like, yes, this is pop music. Like, all these terrible, traumatizing things. I was like, yes, this is actual pop. This is the nature of fandom. This is the nature of the kind of false starts of creativity, the stopping and starting of creativity. That all felt very true to me, in obviously the hyper-real Black Mirror kind of way. But of all the things that we watched or are talking about today, it was the only one that I felt had a genuine tactile appreciation for the pop music. Cam, you were talking about the making of pop music before. Yeah. This, to me, was the best representation of that, with all the cynicism, all the things that basically, when we have pop music meetings here, we're just like, oh, this terrible person did this. Like, stories we can't print, but that we know. That's all in this episode. And maybe there's a reason it's on a TV episode and not in a film. Maybe it couldn't be done as unifyingly in a film as it could be in a one-off episode. But that was the thing that, to me, was the most exciting. So Cam watched half of it. Did anybody else watch it?
No.
Okay.
So I told you,
would just yammer for 30 minutes.
At least watch the first half to see, at least, you know, I turned it off because I had something else to do that was pressing at the moment, but also because I'd reached the point where there's the sister who likes Ashley O, the pop artist, and then there's her sister who likes Sonic Youth. And I was like, if we're going to do...
right.
Like, because their mom who died likes Sonic Youth, and I was like, if we're going to do the rock pop thing
that
again.
Was not a yes. So
I can't do it again.
There's a whole punchline at the end of the episode that really ties that all together. Also, the funny thing about that is the bands that she actually said she likes: Pixies, Sonic Youth, Idols, Savages. And it's funny because then the robot says to her,
Was she 50?
Well, this is the thing. Oh, you only like.
I'm sorry.
The robot says, oh, are those foreign bands? Which is hilarious. It's like a thing that I think any one of us would say. It's funny that it's coming from a robot. That's number one.
Like Alexa, yeah.
Right. And then what's even funnier is the girl, the older sister responds, no, they're vintage.
Yeah, that was right.
Also, I just want to emphasize, Savages is out right now. It's also factually incorrect. There's like a lot of weird stuff. And then she's like, these are bands that my mother liked. Their mother is dead.
So it's mom rock.
And then literally the robot is basically like calls her out and is like, oh, those are just bands your dead mom likes.
Yeah, that was a good burn.
Yeah,
that
was a good burn. Real talk. The album from that robot should be real fire. if it ever comes out. Anyway, please, I want to encourage everybody to watch this episode now. To bring it back, and again, I'm not going to give away the kicker of this episode, but it does loosely tie into Her Smell, in which former fashion models play post-Riot Girl punk musicians.
And Elizabeth Moss.
And Elizabeth Moss. Yes. No. I don't care. Cara Delevingne's in there. Agnes Dean is in this film.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, just like every... That's its own interesting.
And Amber Heard's character also.
All my favorite white women.
No, I have to say, this movie has a great, all my favorite white actresses are in this movie.
And Elizabeth Moss.
Peak white women in this film?
If you like white women, okay.
Peak white women. Yeah, she's really right.
So speak on these peak white women. What is happening at Her Smell? So break it down the plot so that for people who have not seen it.
Wow, you want to take this?
No.
So Elizabeth Moss.
Wait, Meryl Streep is not in this film. Jeez, what are you talking about white women.
I think this is a 5-act movie that kind of takes place in like real time. Elizabeth Moss is a somewhat washed ex-90s Riot Girl band member, and she is a handful.
Like a quasi Courtney Love.
She is definitely Courtney Love, even though Alex Ross Perry has said multiple times that it's not, but it's so obviously Courtney Love.
It really is.
And, you know, it doesn't really tell you in the movie that what kind of problems she has, but you're supposed to assume that she has, you know, substance abuse problems. It's not like Rocket Man where it's, you know, a lot of cocaine scenes.
Right.
She is a mess, and it's just a very anxious movie backstage where she's, you know, screaming at her bandmates, her ex, her baby daddy, or she tries to evict her own child, her infant child, because her shaman tells her it's bad vibes. It's like a whole thing.
To be fair, who among us?
Right. I mean,
I'm childless, but I'm just saying, I can imagine someday.
Baby needs to go.
But your shaman is always getting in there.
I'm just saying, I can imagine someday, 10 years from now, when someone tapped me on the shoulder is like, get the kid out of the room just for a minute. Let's just cleanse this. Let's smudge the room.
Well, every
with
time
a child.
You bring your traditional native healer around the Times building, it does cause
it's true.
Some drama.
I don't want to talk about it.
Two other critics got to go every time I'm in here smudging.
Better for the baby, though, that the baby's not around, frankly. Baby shouldn't have been there.
That's a real talk.
Fair. Also,
but here's why I think the baby was there, was to hold the camera, because the camera work in this movie is nervous AF. The camera work is all over the place.
The baby was a cinematographer.
Yeah, the baby was like this, like just shaking the camera the whole time. Yeah. My Lord. So Her Smell made me really anxious.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in a much better way than Vox Lux made me anxious.
Right.
Like Vox Lux made me anxious in a... I do not trust the aesthetic vision of the people who produced this. Her Smell made me anxious in the, this happened.
Right.
Well, because the stakes feel like real stakes. I mean, they're emotional stakes and they're ethical stakes. It's like how she's treating people is really upsetting.
Right.
And several of the scenes take place, the first one especially, and then the last one that echoes it take place in the run-up before she's supposed to go on stage. And like... Is she gonna? No, I guess the first one is after, right? The first one is after a performance.
But
two of them are before.
Two of them are before.
The first
show.
And the third are before,
right?
And
there's also
the
one in a recording studio, and you're like, just how is this gonna happen? And you feel the real time and the shaky cam, you know, creates this enormous anxiety, and you just are like,
is she going to be okay? Is anyone going to be okay? But it's very specific, and it's very specific to all of the relationships that she's involved in that she has this absolutely toxic effect on.
And that is how records were made in the 90s. That's not how they were made in the 2010s. But in the 90s, I do firmly believe that all records were made by incredibly toxic people who were overstaying their studio time and fighting with each other constantly.
And I think this movie is definitely a great reflection of that. I also think that it's really, the thing I really, really love about it is that it's really pro-artifice. I think for like Elizabeth Moss, it, you know, it is, you know, as Kristen was pointing out, it's like these five scenes, these five acts, and for three out of the five, she is a mess. And, you know, there are moments when she, you know, she might be drunk, she might be high, it doesn't really matter what she is, because there are moments when she lapses into the Scarlett O'Hara Southern thing.
Yeah, uh-huh.
She's yelling at her mom, she's throwing things, she's assaulting people, but it's also held together by everyone else's concern and nervousness about her being the end of this band, them not going on stage, I mean, frankly, at one point they don't get on stage because she attacks people. But then I think what's really interesting is that it gets really, really, really quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, before she goes on stage again, she asks this question of, you know, is this going to be the day that I don't make it or something like that? Like there's a real poignant through line here of alcoholism, addiction, whichever thing it is that's plaguing her. There's a real sympathetic through line here that for all the artifice, the movie doesn't lose sight of. And that's sort of what's impressive to me about it.
Yeah. And it's not that the pain is just the source of and resolved in the songs. I mean, the pain is there and it's connected to the talent. But the talent is also really interesting.
Yeah.
Everyone else has sort of stuck with her because their careers are dependent on it, but also because you get the sense that she's genuinely brilliant. And when she's going off on some of these rants, she says things that are just incredible. Like she just sort of quote Shakespeare, she'll make this kind of wordplay, and it all seems to be coming straight off the top of your head. And so it's a really convincing portrait of someone who is just a kind of an exceptional talent and verbal wit who is always, you know, a millimeter away from just completely losing control of everything and destroying herself and everyone around her. And that's where the drama and the tension and the pathos comes from.
And this film, interestingly, to your point, is the least reliant upon music of all the films.
Only
we're
four
talking.
Songs on the album, which I'm very disappointed by, and I want more songs.
I would love to hear more songs, right?
I would love more songs.
I want the Something She Box.
Yeah. Right. I love the Something She Box.
But I think to Tony's point, it's a film about musicians that's not about music. Like the scene is a pretext, the era is a pretext. It's about this kind of fascinating, troubled, ski slope nightmare of a person. It could be about the disco era. It could be about doo-wop. I'd actually like to see that.
I would love
to see if anybody would like to make a doo-wop version of this. I'd love to see it. But it's actually not so much. If anything, the scene, which is to say like early to mid 90s female post-riot girl indie rock, is just kind of like a signifier to basically be like, you know what this is. Like you kind of get the vibe, and then that frees the characters up to kind of be the most malicious, absurd, toxic versions of themselves, because they haven't had to earn. Inside the pop framework, there's this thing where it's like you have to earn the weirdness, because it's like, oh, it's just cheesy pop music. Like it couldn't possibly be interesting, which is the framework a lot of these films work in. But here, the framework is counterculture. So a sort of centrist film goer would just be like, oh, okay, they're already weird and screwed up. So then Elizabeth Moss gets to just like do this magic. I mean, just even I'm looking at the cover, which weirdly as like a Bob Marley cover for some reason. It's like, I don't know what's going on here.
I know what you're talking about.
That's like a strange choice. But just like her, it's her with her tongue out, that kind of evil. And not in a sinister, in a like genuinely unhinged, like maybe the tongue is not connected to any other nerves kind of way, and it's just going to be out there attacking you. And I'm PTSDing from that film just looking at this image.
But then there's that fascinating in the quiet part, because after she's sort of had whatever, you know, kind of breakdown or calamity she's had, she's out in the country.
Great house.
And her
it is great house.
Her kid, who's now like 6 or 7 or whatever, comes to visit her and asks her to play a song. And she plays a piano cover.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Bryan Adams.
Heaven. Bryan Adams.
Take.
So, one take. And that is, talk about like the sort of the rock pop dichotomy being complicated. Absolutely sincere, you know, not a dry eye.
How is
moment.
That not on this soundtrack?
I know.
Don't even get me started on with a soundtrack.
Pedro, if we can find this, if we can find it. So just briefly, if Pedro can find heaven, we're going to play it right now. And if you can't find heaven, you should go find heaven somewhere.
Oh, thinking about all our younger years, there was only you and me. We were young and wild and free. Now nothing can take you away from me. We've been down this road before, but that's over now. You keep me coming back for more. Baby, you're all that I want. When you're lying here in my arms, I'm finding it hard to believe we're in heaven. Love is all that I need, and I found it there in your heart. It isn't too hard to see we're in heaven.
Cam, to your point, Something She is excellent. There does not appear to be a pure Something She song on the original motion picture soundtrack, which, as you mentioned, is 4 songs and 7 minutes and 59 seconds long.
You have to sit through the trauma of the movie to hear the songs. That's how they get you.
Wow. But there are some Acker Girl songs.
Yes.
If you're wanting
to hear.
They're
great, too.
Yeah, Cara Delevingne, Ashley Benson, and
Dylan Galula.
Dylan, is it Galula or Jolie? It's Galula.
Oh, I don't know,
but she's hilarious on Twitter.
I love her, yeah.
I was up on her on Twitter a long time ago.
She's the best Twitter.
Fire on Twitter. Yeah. And also very good in
this
film.
The not many songs, I mean, that's kind of the whole suspense of the movie, and it's sort of like what it's like to be in the audience, and like, are they going to show up? Are they going to go on? You know, you're standing there waiting.
It's cut to me in the audience looking at my watch and just being like, are they going to go on?
The deadline.
I literally have to file tonight.
But you know, to the earlier point we were making about what this kind of movie makes you earn, you know, it's worth noting that when this movie, I mean, when it was first playing at festivals, there were walkouts. This movie assaults
no.
you.
And it had yeah. no distribution. It had it
and
took
it,
a while
had distribution,
for it to
right.
Wait, why? This is the best of these movies.
Because think it about is, seeing yeah. it in a theater, big screen, as loud. It gets really, it's a really loud movie. It's a very, like, emotionally oppressive movie, and it's 3 sections of that before you get to the quiet. So it is also
that
really
you have
testing
to watch her
you.
Puke. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, it's really putting you through like
the best stuff. Though.
You don't have to earn that from the movie. Doesn't really like to start her earn that. It really makes you sit through that up front, mm-hmm. and then you get to the other stuff. But the movie's like, no, you're going to confront this wildness before we get to that other stuff,
and her full ugliness just as a person, and it sort of brings her back from that in an interesting way. And then there are all those great. All the 5 sections are interspersed with this sort of like old video of them, you know, in their younger days when they first got signed, when they first got the gold record. So you see the whole sort of arc of rise and fall, but it's not done in the usual musical biopic way.
I will say, the first time I heard someone like this movie was you, Cam.
Everyone else hated it. You're
I
right.
just heard that it was
is that really
terrible,
true?
And then yeah. Cam was the first one to be like, I think I liked it. Like, I was like, oh, wow, okay.
I didn't really, see, because I'm not kind of like paying as close attention to those micro movements and mm-hmm. in film criticism, like, I'm blown away to hear that, because this was, out of all these films, like, so far and away, like,
yeah, I agree.
The most visceral, the most vivid, the most sui generis, like, the most shocking, but in a completely pleasant way, even though I was traumatized by it.
Some of that.
And Elizabeth Moss is just like,
oh, she's amazing.
An A++, like holy shit, extra credit.
Yeah.
But some of this is in the film critic world. I think Alex Ross Perry is a very divisive figure.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh yes.
Yeah,
and
sure.
how?
Yes.
Yeah.
What?
For sure.
Well, my problem with him is he's so white. Like,
I love it. Keep going.
Speak on it. Speak on
there
it.
Is an outline article called Rated W for White, and really? It has me quoted in it as the only critic to bring up how white this movie is in all the reviews of her smell. And it's just his, it's just a problem of his. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not, the shaman is the only non-white character.
I was
character.
Just going to say, the shaman.
But, you know, even that is very tokenist.
There's a, are all his films set in white milieu?
Kind of. I mean, like Golden Exes, it's really offensive because it takes place in Brooklyn. You don't see a single person of color even in the background. And I'm like, what kind of white utopia are you filming this in?
In The Color Wheel, which was his first released, second completed movie, he's in it. And it's this weird kind of brother and sister incest story. And there is a point at which the main characters just go off in this just shockingly racist kind of which is kind of ironic but kind of not, and it's a moment where it's sort of flooring the pedal of audience discomfort, which is something that he likes to do. In a way, Her Smell is his sort of his gentlest and most pleasing movie. I mean, he did the previous two that Elizabeth Moss was in. What was it? Queen of Earth, and then also Listen Up, Philip.
Which people like. I think Listen Up, Philip is the one people really like.
Yeah, and that's the one with Jason Schwartzman, and it's set in the notably monochromatically white literary world.
I don't know. Schwartzman seems like a twerp, so I don't know. If that's...
Well, see this movie then. If that's your preconception of Jason Schwartzman, you need to see.
It's a really good vehicle for that. Yeah,
it's beyond
peak twerp.
Yeah.
Maybe the way to close out. I feel like maybe we need to heal a little bit with Blaze. What do you think?
I'm always here. They can make biopics about every single Texas songwriter.
Yeah,
I'll be happy. I'll be there for the Guy Clark movie, for the Towns Van Zandt movie, for the
Lean Sipper to Towns Van Zandt. Tony, explain what Blaze is. And as I said to Cam before, because he was gonna maybe try to watch it before this, I enjoyed this movie, but you really do only have to watch like the first half hour to 45 minutes to kind of get the vibe. Although the end is very frightening and unsettling.
Yeah, the end. Because the other kind of biopic that we haven't talked about so much, musical biopic, is the early death biopic. The Jim Morrison, or everyone who was in the plane that went down with Buddy Holly, has gotten their own, you know. But in those cases, it's sort of like the deaths are given a sort of meaning or a kind of moralized way. And this is just this random awful thing that happened and that took away this guy. There's not a lot of Blaze Foley recordings, and it was done fairly. I mean, most of them sound like demos or live bootleg recordings.
And he was covered by other people who recorded some of his material as well.
And so it just has this whole kind of like 70s kind of back to the land. Everything has sort of fallen apart. We're
so
all
hazy,
just
like
sitting
all,
around.
Yeah, first of all, like all the fabrics in this, all the fibers are natural. It's not a synthetic fiber in sight in this film.
It does feel
and
like a very
old
hemp
and
movie.
Filthy, yeah. Dude. It's hemp that someone has slept in for a week.
Oh,
you know?
Great.
And for real, I think they went full.
Like, I really feel
that.
Like you want to talk, I mean, I assume there's got to be some method going on with that jacket, like the one Blaze Foley jacket.
Yes.
Like, I feel like my man wore that straight through for a month just to get it. The proper molding.
Yes, because Blaze Foley had probably worn a similar jacket for like 12 years.
Yeah. Shout out to my guy Boris Bijan Saberi out here molding his clothes to his body, but you know. So Blaze, I found maybe not as affecting as you found it, but I did the love scenes, the kind of up in the treehouse, young couple in love, Blaze, this kind of like big polio stricken, walks with a limp, galoot with an unerring artistic sense, in love with a young Jewish woman whose parents reject him
and who's an actress. They're also both artists. Like they meet. She's in this kind of experimental theater company somewhere in the Texas Hill Country. I'm not too clear on.
Again, it's very 70s. It's very natural fiber.
Was
there one in every town there of must 2000 be, but, in Texas?
But
in
what's
era?
Great about this movie is how far it goes in that. Because even that, like whatever experimental theater collective, and even the broken down roadhouse music scene, that's too mainstream and too commercial. They have to go live in a treehouse all by themselves in their underwear, smoking weed all the time to get into the true artistic. So in a way it's a movie that does have some idea of the creative process and some interest in showing, if not the details of it, at least the kind of the rhythm and the mood of it.
But again, and this to go back to Rocket Man a little bit, there is a little bit of like, I just write these songs. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit of that where it's not like he's not what we were talking about before, like slaving over the words and like, oh, like tearing pages out and throwing them in the corner. Like, it's none of that. It's just like, I get super drunk and I wrote a bunch of words on the wall and look, it's a lullaby. You know?
Like, I kind of buy that. Yeah. Actually.
Yeah, I sort of that I get.
I felt like that might have been how it went down.
So do you just paint your walls a lot?
Is that you know, they're artists. I'm not an artist. Oh. Artists do all kinds of stuff. Like, that to me seems richer than things that I just feel like were much more complicated in real life. Like, I really think that Freddie Mercury's writing process was more complicated than it comes off in Bohemian Rhapsody by a mile. But this actually sounds like more genuine to me.
And it's very local, small scale. Like, this, it's not about global pop icons. Right. You know, it's about a sort of marginal culty figures in this weird, offbeat scene. If Townes Van Zandt is the most famous
guy in your movie.
You know,
and also it's but even more so, that's why I kept resenting that it kept coming back to Townes Van Zandt. I understand he's the most famous guy, and there's this like weird.
Also, Charlie Sexton is playing him, who is an interesting musician and is just so charismatic in a way.
I found him annoying AF. I did not find him charismatic. I was like, shut your yap. Like, it was just so they kept trying to revalidate Blaze by putting him in Townes's mouth. And I was so charmed by Blaze that I didn't need that validation. Mm. It's almost like it didn't.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's almost like the film didn't trust its own material, didn't trust the charisma of the person that the film is about, that they kept having to refer back to some other narrative thing. I'm like, just write a scene. Something crazy happened, write the scene. Don't let Townes say it to me. It's basically to me. It's basically your Townes. And I'm just here like, tell me a crazy story. And Townes is like, well, do I have a crazy Blaze story for you?
Something
that happens like five times.
Something I wonder about a movie like this, though, you know, Elton John, Queen, like, these are people or groups for whom there's going to be multiple movies, or there conceivably could be in terms of fiction, documentary, et cetera. For this, I wonder.
To make millions.
Right.
Yes.
And for this, I wonder about not making a documentary, or, you know, I think about the Oscars, at least. There have been three recent music documentaries, Amy, 20 Feet from Stardom, and Searching for Sugar Man, all winners. It's like a category of thing that we do the sort of rediscovery of the artist or the artist persona or whatever through documentary. I'm curious about, like, for smaller artists, why we would go with the fiction version. And it's not a judgment call. It's like a, rather on my end, it's like not a judgment. It's like, I'm curious about that.
That's a really interesting
question.
Because you could see Blaze working. Well, I mean, it in a way, the other documentary that it sort of made me think of was the one about Lee Morgan. They called him
Morgan, which is a great documentary.
Fantastic. And could easily have been. I mean, the story is quite remarkable and strange and tragic, and could have been a feature film. But in that case, I was glad it wasn't, because it had that, just a sort of a weirdness in a way. Because there are things that happen in these people's lives that are much more kind of random and strange than that are just the kinks that would be ironed out if you were making it into any kind of feature.
Also, I wonder in the case of Blaze specifically, if there just isn't enough source material and all the key players. I mean, Blaze obviously dead, Townes Van Zandt dead. You would basically just have a bunch of secondary or tertiary players and then kind of people providing like meta narrative and critical context.
Right.
But maybe there's not loads of, I don't know if there's loads of archival video of him, like, you know, like maybe you can do one of those like VH1 type talking heads things, but maybe you couldn't do like a I Was There documentary. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Also, with many narrative films, I am, you know, tuning into the life of a person that I don't know. And I feel like I'm more likely to do that with, you know, a real person.
Interesting.
Also,
sure.
That's true.
Totally.
Like, I feel
sense.
Like a lot of times if I'm going to see a documentary, it's because it's a subject or a person that I'm already interested in, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
But it would basically require the narrativization of it in order to get the buy-in from a
filmgoer. Like, yeah.
Makes total sense.
I feel like there are flaws in both forms for me, because I'm for sure agreeing with you that I usually go to the documentary if I know something about the artist, but I often feel like that's saying that many of those documentaries aren't interesting as movies, so I'm just going to them for the info. Whereas with movies, it's like I always, the fiction features, I always think the risk is like, just scenes. Like, so many moot lives don't lend themselves to scenes in that way. Yeah. Like, two people in a room talking or arguing or doing cocaine or whatever. And a lot of those movies fall in. Like, an Amy Winehouse movie, I don't know that I want to watch that because I feel like they're going to reduce it to the mess in a way that a documentary, well, that documentary, I think, also
Incarcerated.
Also did that.
Yeah. Sorry. I would like another Amy doc, honestly. I did not like Amy.
But that one won the Oscar, so who's going to make another one?
Right, exactly.
Like a person who wants to make
a good movie. We should make a movie.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
There must be a feature in the works, I feel like.
I've got to assume.
Yeah.
Because I also feel like her estate is very, I don't want to say like, greedy. I think like they're mining the material. Yeah. I think they're, and some in a mostly I would say in a useful and positive way.
Yeah.
But I think they also understand the narrative value of what they have and the aesthetic value of the unreleased material.
I'm anxious about a Prince documentary now too, or a movie rather. I'm not anxious about a Prince documentary, but a movie. I don't know.
Okay, before we go, who should play Prince in the inevitable bad movie?
Oh my God.
Not Rami Malek. I would kill myself.
Diggy Simmons. Wait, did you say Diggy Simmons? I think you did. No, anyone have any hot ideas about who should play Prince?
Oh God, that's so free.
No, I don't think they've been born yet. I don't think I've seen the person.
Or it has to be what's the Todd Haynes Bob Dylan movie?
Oh, I'm not there.
I'm not there. Yeah. Like something like that, seven. Where it's
everybody.
Right.
Yes. We all
where
play
it's kind
Prince.
Of weird. Yes. Yeah.
Jafar from Aladdin gets to have his segment where he's Prince.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Moss.
I would watch the hell out of
the
that.
Cast of Big Little Lies. <East kids.
laughs> Meryl Streep is Prince.
Yes, Meryl.
Let's go out from Blaze and Sybil's Lullaby. This is Ben Dickey, who plays Blaze, and Alia Shawkat, who plays Sybil. And just, like, hold a person you love or like.
There's a rabbit hole that leads down into hell, dear. You could jump down if you wanna, but you can't come home. There's a tall golden ladder that stretches high up into heaven. You could climb up if you wanna, but you can't come home. Or you could stay with me for a little while.
That is our show. Thank you to the gang. Ayo, Tony Scott, Cam Collins, Kristen Yunsu Kim. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me. Okay, email me if you know who should play Prince. Email me also if you were traumatized by Vox Lux. Email me also if you have written a dissertation on the connection between pop music and, I guess, terrorism and American politics or global politics. I'd like to read it. Podcast at nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, yada, yada, yada. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
And riding rainbows glide on earthly byways, but you can't come home.
Or you could stay with me for a little while. You know that home is wherever you are. Let me ride the lonely miles with you.